We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The mapping of the human genome was one of the biggest projects in the history of biological science. It has already had profound implications for human health, but there are a lot of questions that remain. Questions like this: how many diseases have a genetic basis? And can we use what we've learned to develop new therapies for disease? Who should profit from all of this? Should anyone be able to profit? This morning in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with science writer Victor McElhenney about his book, Drawing the Map of Life Inside the Human Genome Project. It's published by Basic Books and come out recently. And it is the story of the research effort, how it is that came about, what it is we think we might be able to do with what we've learned. And it goes into a number of actually rather surprising areas, things that really go beyond human health. The implications are very wide, and I think that the guest would argue, many scientists would argue, that we are just beginning to appreciate that and to think about the practical implications of this work. So if you're interested in reading a one-volume history of this, this is a good book to look at. And as we talk this morning, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And you may also send your questions by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. So whatever way you want to participate, you're certainly welcome. We just hope people will keep their questions to questions and try to keep them on the topic and keep them brief, and that will help us to keep moving along. Mr. McElhenney, hello.
Oh, good morning, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, delighted to be here.
Let me just real quick say that Victor McElhenney has reported for Science Magazine, the Boston Globe, the New York Times. He also founded the Knight Science Journalism Fellowship at MIT, which he ran for a number of years, and has written a number of books. And I know that you've done a lot of writing about science, and you've had the opportunity to cover some big stories, including the moon landing. But this topic, biological science, genetics, has, I think, been a particular interest of yours. How would you rank this, the Human Genome Project, say, among the big things that have happened in science, say, just in the past half century? How would you rank this?
I think biology has been the dominant science in the last half century, and I think that this is the biggest thing in terms of its scale that has ever happened in biology. It's kind of hard to say that something is more important than Darwin's investigation of evolution or Mendel's experiments with inheritance, but this project is on the greatest scale that's ever been seen in biology.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about its scale, I suppose you can talk about the number of people involved. You can talk about the amount of money that has been spent.
Right.
But perhaps the important thing is to recognize the object in question, just how complicated that really is, and how within the genome, just how much information is contained there.
Well, that's true. We're trying with this project, the scientists involved have been trying to pick apart the machinery of disease, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we're also interested in normal function too, but disease has many causes. The picture of a particular disease, what actually happens in the cells of the body to in a disease, is extraordinarily complicated, and that's a problem of a complexity probably greater than ever examined in science, even in basic physics or cosmology. We're dealing with something enormously complex, which can't happen without the incredible capacity of the computers and the related software that have been springing up over the last 30 years or so.
Yeah, I think that that's an important point, that the tools, first of all, the hardware, the machinery to be able to do the sequencing, if it wasn't for that, we would probably wouldn't be at this point. But I think also that the software that's necessary to try to interpret all of this and the effort to interpret it is just, without that, we wouldn't be able to apply what was learned. And as far as that is concerned, we're just right at the very beginning of making sense of a growing data bank that seems to be growing every day.
Well, it's exploding, really. And I think people, as they look forward in trying to make use of this in order to help people who are sick, or who might become sick, the software and the computers are really the central problem of how to organize this information and how to actually learn things from it. Those are really very central issues.
Mm-hmm. And how common is it now that if you have a case, you have a medical case, someone who is ill, and it's a very difficult diagnosis where physicians, with doctors, just aren't quite sure what's wrong, and until you decide that, you can't decide on how you're going to treat. How common is it now that when you get to a situation like that, some kind of genetic screen is going to be done to assist in the diagnosis?
Well, that's really just beginning, and it's particularly beginning in major medical centers. Some of the major centers of treatment of cancer have begun to genotype all their cancer patients. They're starting slowly with this because it involves a huge amount of data, but they are beginning to do that in order to make a decision about which cancer drug to start with, let's say in a program of chemotherapy. They're trying to match up the genome of the cancer cell and the normal cell in that person and with the drugs. So we're learning more about which drugs can do what. We also are learning a lot more about who is going to do well on a particular drug and who will do poorly. So that type of thing has already begun, and there are other examples. Of course, for quite a while, when you think of 3,000 or more genetic diseases, most of those are rare and afflict a few people, but afflict them catastrophically in many cases. There's been a tremendous amount of prenatal testing to see whether the fetus is affected, and also of parents-to-be to find out whether they're carrying some rare genetic defect. That's been more normal for longer.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, let me do one thing real quick. Victor McElhinney is our guest in this hour of Focus. He's a science writer. He's reported for Science Magazine, the Boston Globe, the New York Times, and has done a lot of writing about biological science, and particularly human genetics. And he's the author of a recently published book. It's titled Drawing the Map of Life Inside the Human Genome Project. It's published by Basic Books, and it tries to tell the story of the project and how it proceeded and some of the important individuals who were involved in this work and why it matters. So you might take a look at that book if that is a subject that interests you. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And you can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. To take a step back perhaps for a moment, I think that if you start asking people, well, what do you know about DNA? They maybe will have this kind of vague notion that, well, DNA is something that's in us and that it makes us who we are as a distinct person. We get it from our parents. That's quite as we look like our parents. That genes are all involved in that, in determining, you know, what we look like, and perhaps also in determining our tendency to certain diseases, our risk for certain diseases. But that's all kind of vague, and maybe it would be useful to ask a question like, well, for someone who is not a scientist, what's really important for people to understand about DNA?
Well, I think they should understand that it's if you stretched it all out, it would be about 6 feet long. It's the same in virtually every cell of your body. It's packed very, very tightly inside of something, the cell, which is too small for you to see in a microscope, except for a very powerful one. That's where the information that is going to direct just how all the cells do their work, and also to make sure that you have a nice, accurate copy of your DNA to pass on to your children. So this is a molecule that contains information, and that information is used every millisecond, and it's also used at the time when a new creature is created. All living creatures, except for a very few viruses, their nuclear material, their information bank, is DNA. With that information bank is really called on all the time, but also at longer intervals.
Mm-hmm.
So we are, you know, ourselves. Life is an information problem.
Mm. So I think the other level that people think about is the fact that it's the thing that that assists in the propagation of a species. It's the thing that says if you're going to make another one, this is what it's supposed to look like. I think that's maybe they focus on that a little bit more than the other thing that says it's part of our operating systems.
Absolutely. And, you know, in any given cell in your body, lots of the instructions for particular proteins, we seem to have a set of genes, as they're called, units of heredity, about 20,000 of those. And those specify maybe 150,000 or more proteins. A lot of those in any given cell, like in a liver cell or a cell in your brain or whatever, are turned off.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not needed for that particular organ's function. But there still are thousands of them that are on, that are making a few of this and a few of that according to need.
And the idea behind the project is to take the whole thing, or at least to take the to look at this 20,000 genes or so.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. The idea really is to speed up our ability to understand the mechanism of genetics in disease. We know environment is very important, but we also know that genetics is important. And the task of teasing apart what your environment does to you and what your inheritance does to you is extraordinarily complicated. And 30 years ago or so, we were facing having to do this disease by disease. And the scientists were beginning to throw up their hands and saying, we can't, this is just going to take too long. We're not going to be able to tackle cancer problems in a real way in any time soon. And we want to get there a lot faster. So the idea was to sequence the whole thing, all your DNA, so that you would have all the information connected with all of your proteins right there. If the thought was that that would accelerate understanding the role of genetics in disease.
Mm-hmm. Now, also, though, I think that at the outset, not all biologists thought that this was a good idea, or at least that it was worth the effort.
Well, they thought it was just too big. They thought it smacked of building a great big atom smasher outside of Geneva or something like that. They thought of it as involving massive teams of hundreds of people working on a particular experimental machine at a place like that. They just didn't like the idea of big science. They also, many of them, were doing a lot of very good work on individual organisms or individual diseases in small groups. They thought that those kinds of small group in interactions were crucial to having the very best ideas, the best hypotheses. And this all just didn't smell right to them.
Mm-hmm.
They also were afraid that a big project like this was going to suck all the money out of the room, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the interesting parts about the story, that is how the research effort proceeded, because, as you say, I think in the beginning when people thought about this, they thought, well, this is so big, the project here is so big, that what they envisioned was something like a genetic version of the Manhattan Project. But it turned out that that wasn't the way that it was done.
No, it wasn't. For one thing, the project as it was designed finally, after a good deal of argument, was to keep the most exciting parts of the existing biology, many of them involved with what you call model organisms, kind of lab rat organisms like yeast and a tiny worm called C. elegans. The genetics of those were very, very important. They were expanding biology very rapidly, and they were going to be essential to understanding what you found when you did the whole human genome. So we kept kind of the best of what was going on and incorporated it into the project. Also, it was insisted that this would be, quote, new money, unquote, that is, in addition to the existing appropriations for biological research. Congress was asked whether it was willing to do that, and the answer was rather quick, yes, so that the remaining programs were not, as far as we can see, directly impinged on by the new effort.
Well, it certainly was a significant amount of money that we spent, but if you compare it to other big science projects, say the cost of building a big collider or something like the Manhattan Project, it was actually significantly less.
Well, absolutely, and it was also totally non-secret. It involved scientists all over the world. We should reflect that America spends about $2.5 trillion a year on all aspects of medical care, several hundred million dollars of that for bureaucracy, probably. But that's a very, very big bill. We have something called the National Institutes of Health that's based in Washington, but which spends most of its money in laboratories all over the place, including right where you all are, a very notable research place. That total budget is somewhat over $30 billion. Which is like 1.5% of the whole nation's health bill. The genetic program in one institute of those national institutes, the Genome Research Institute, that budget is on the order of $500 million a year, which is a tiny proportion. It's a couple of percent of the total health research budget of NIH. So we're talking about a very modest amount of money, which is being spent by a few thousand scientists around the world. Mm-hmm. Now, that money is matched, more than matched, by the work of pharmaceutical companies and seed companies and so on also around the world. There are thousands of scientists that work in those places, spending probably larger amounts of money every year on DNA science. Mm-hmm.
Our guest in this hour, Victor McElhenney. He's the author of the newly published book, Drawing the Map of Life, which is all about the Human Genome Project. We have a caller. Would welcome others. We'll go here to someone in Piatt County, and they're on line number 4.
Oh, good morning.
Yes.
I have nothing scientific to contribute, but as a literary person, I just finished a book by Richard Powers called The Goldbug Variations. And it concerns a lab, I assume fictional lab, at the University of Illinois in the 50s, where they were just starting work on this project. And it's just an incredible analysis of the problems that they face and were trying to look to the future about what it is that they were trying to do and the different people who were on fellowships here at the university and manages to combine a story on a scientist who was just so overwhelmed by what he saw were the implications of this and finally quit his research. And it was really very scientific. And I just thought if anybody's literary out there, after they finish your book, they could read a fictional version and with a lot of I think the rivalries and jealousies and things that went on in the lab and race to get papers out and competition. It was just very, very informative. So I just thought I'd recommend that.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. I don't know, Mr. McElhenney, do you know the book?
I don't know that book. I think it should be to those of us, and I think that's really everybody with a literary interest, there are not too many really good fictional treatments of science. One of the most notable is a novel that probably most people haven't read called Arrowsmith, which was published in the mid-1920s. I believe it got the Pulitzer Prize. That has to do with a scientist working on the problem of plague at what is actually the Rockefeller University in New York City. That novel is a very, very powerful discussion of the interplay between medicine and science, and indeed the rivalries that the caller spoke of are very much there, and there's a lot of other very classical issues. The people in the 1950s, some of whom were indeed at the University of Illinois and doing early research on these things, were aware of the kind of cosmic significance of what they were doing. Right then, DNA's structure, the double helix, that twisted staircase structure of DNA, that had just been discovered in 1953. And people were working on bacteria and their viruses as model systems for how life worked. People understood that this was something really very, very big. I mean, I began to report about these matters a few years after that in 1960. People understood, even in very early days, that this science of life was going to be tremendously important, and of course, if it is, you want to be first in finding something out.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the comment of the caller. Others are welcome. Questions 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. One thing that I think is particularly curious is that if you look at the where within the federal government there was interest in doing this research, one of the places where there was a lot of interest was the Department of Energy. And that, to me, that seems surprising that the Department of Energy, you could see the National Institutes of Health, yes, they were also interested in it early on as well. But why people in DOE were interested in this?
Well, on my bookshelf just in front of me here, I see a title of a manual that was written in 1957 called The Effects of Nuclear Weapons. The Department of Energy is involved in manufacturing the material that is used in nuclear weapons. It is also, of course, very interested in alternative forms of energy besides nuclear power. The Department of Energy is always concerned about the biological effects of radiation, and they have been concerned about that from day one. Radioactive isotopes from reactors started to be used in medical research in the late 1940s. Oak Ridge had a great big biological laboratory there, doing some very interesting work in genetics. There's always the concern about the genetic effect of the use of nuclear weapons. That's why the populations of Hiroshima and Nagasaki have been studied ever since then to see if there have been genetic effects from the use of the nuclear weapons there. This is a huge concern to the Department of Energy, and they're very serious about it. They saw a chance in the middle 80s to use their tremendous expertise in large-scale computing to work on problems of how living systems work in health and disease. And they jumped on this. They were very enthusiastic about it. The fact that they were actually worried the National Institutes of Health a lot, because they were afraid that the most dramatic project in biology was going to essentially be led by another agency.
Mm-hmm. Another interesting feature of the story is the fact that, first of all, the effort began with this publicly funded effort with people working inside the National Institutes of Health. There was a team that was led first by James Watson, the Watson of Watson and Crick, the guys who discovered DNA, and then later Francis Collins. So there was that effort. They started out first, and then there was a private effort that was led by a man named Craig Venter. So there was some rivalry, and there was something of a race to see who would get there first. What was the difference between the approaches of the two teams?
Well, I think, you know, the account that you've given is the one that we were really drew a tremendous amount of public attention in the late 1990s when Venter's private company called Celera Genomics was racing with the public project, which was a worldwide project. That created what you might call a sort of dualism, and I think that that turns out to be a rather artificial picture. You see, you couldn't think of doing a genome project without appropriate laboratory instruments, like a machine for spelling out the sequence of the DNA, or a machine for amplifying a tiny sample of DNA in order to have enough of it to examine. Those machines came right smack out of private industry. In the case of the sequencers, it's even more complicated because a lot of the early work that led toward commercial machines called sequencers was done in a laboratory at the California Institute of Technology with support from the National Science Foundation, a U.S. government agency. That then marched its way, with some difficulty, into the private sector, into a company. The company, and it had some rivals too, developed these machines, which just flowered as conceivably useful in a laboratory at about the time people were saying, we ought to do this genome project. So, and of course, the computers have done their evolution in private industry. No computers, no sequencers, no DNA amplifiers, no genome projects. So the technical ground for the project certainly is very importantly contributed by the private sector. At the same time, the products of this have to then make their way into laboratories, which are mostly supported by government and by generous individuals and by foundations and so on. Those people have to make use of these machines, learn how to do them, make sure the companies know how to make them, make sure that the whole thing works. So what we're really talking about is a kind of competition and collaboration going on at the same time. So the line between private and public on this is pretty hard to draw. The approaches, if you're at a profit-making company, like a drug company, of course you choose what stage of a problem to look at because you're trying to develop drugs that can be sold for a profit to generate the profits to make more drugs in the future. So you're going to look at it in a slightly different way that way. But intellectually, I don't see much of a divide.
Early on, I think also one of the big questions was, what would become of what was learned? And would there be some question of someone trying to declare that that was proprietary and that they owned it? And as it turned out, the government-sponsored team, as it went along, once it had something, it immediately released it. So it all got out into the open. And in fact, I think ultimately that wasn't so good for Celera. The fact that it was all of that information was publicly available, but I think that a lot of people would argue that that was really important. In fact, that it was all made publicly available, and no one said, "Well, this is ours; it belongs to us. If you want to look at it, you're going to have to pay us some money."
Well, certainly there was a very pragmatic concern among the people who wanted to be sure that all the DNA sequence was posted on the web each night. As they found it. And that was speed. That is, the whole point of the project was to speed stuff up, to get the knowledge quicker. And the way to do that, of course, is to have such information as you have out there for everyone to look at so that then they can get a bright idea and push the envelope further. So the idea was that secrecy or intellectual property or proprietary stuff and so on would get in the way of going fast on this. So there was a kind of practical as well as, you might say, a moral argument to have the information out there, and it is indeed out there. We mustn't forget, though, that there are a great many patents, thousands of them, on particular genes, to say nothing of techniques and so on. There's a big fight going on right now about a patent on the genes for two different mutations that can predispose people to breast cancer. There's a company in Salt Lake City, Myriad Genetics. That patent is under very serious challenge in the federal courts right now. People are very worried about a specific patent like that. So this is not a dead issue, even though the databases are out there and are very, very public. There's still a lot of, quote, intellectual property, unquote, issues.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I'm sure people would say that they knew about DNA was the idea that each individual's DNA is unique. And that's what makes it possible to do something like, you know, using DNA evidence and to establish guilt in a criminal matter, or to establish whether an individual is the parent of another individual. So you couldn't just take one person's DNA and map that and then say, well, this is it, because everybody else is going to be different. So you have to take some number of individuals and put that all together. And yet still, can you say that you've actually, if you've done that, can you say you've actually mapped the genome?
Well, certainly people like James Watson, the co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, he certainly thinks that we're not really going to be able to make sense of this until thousands of individual humans have been sequenced. I think that argument's based on the fact that one individual will differ by as many as as much as 1%, that is, 3 million different differences from, let's say, a reference sequence of the sort that's published on the web. So there's tremendous amount of difference between people, but it doesn't add up to much more than 1% of our DNA, but you do have these hundreds of thousands, millions of variations. The idea of sequencing thousands of people is starting to look practical. A program was announced in June in England that they're going to do 10,000 people. Another place is going to do the protein coding part of another 10,000 people with respect to heart disease. So the price of doing this has been plummeting. It's one of the most remarkable things in the history of technology. These sequencing machines are in new generations, becoming maybe 100,000 times less expensive in producing a human sequence than was true only 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So this is truly amazing, and it's just sort of happening rather quietly. Not very many people are paying too much attention to this. But it does mean that this sort of sequencing is going to be part of normal clinical evaluation and treatment pretty soon.
And what now is the cost to sequence one individual?
Well, you have people throw around numbers. It looks as if it's in the neighborhood of $10,000 right now. If you went another order of magnitude, another tenfold, it would be $1,000, and you'd be, you know, down in the CAT scan range. The move in that direction is toward the $1,000 genome or cheaper, happening very fast. It was just announced yesterday that one new type of sequencing technology is being purchased for an upfront price of about $375 million. A company called Ion Torrent is being bought by a company called Life Technologies. So there's a tremendous amount of excitement about this collapsing price of sequencing.
We have about 15 minutes left in this hour of Focus. Our guest is science writer Victor McElhenney. He's reported for Science Magazine, the Boston Globe, the New York Times, and has done a lot of writing about genetic science, other scientific topics too, but this has been a main interest of his, a major interest for a long time. He founded the Knight Science Journalism Fellowship at NIT, MIT, which he ran from 1982 until 1988. He's the author of a number of books, including the most recent Drawing the Map of Life Inside the Human Genome Project, and it is published by Basic Books. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and we'll talk at will-talk@illinois.edu. That's our email. I want to give you an opportunity to talk some more about practical applications of the work, because I think probably for most people that's really the thing that they're going to tune in on the most. They're going to say, well, okay, maybe I sort of understand the science and maybe I sort of don't. But the idea is that the hope is that what we've learned about connections between genes and disease will help develop therapies to help people who are sick. Where do things stand now with that?
With helping people who
helping
are sick?
Helping people who are sick.
Well, I think the first area, which I briefly mentioned a few minutes ago, has to do with diagnosis. That is, what is the exact problem? Is this the form of a cancer that will recur quickly, or is this a less aggressive kind of cancer? That sort of thing. Those sorts of questions can be answered with DNA-related technologies, not merely with these sequencing machines that I've been talking about, but also with another device that samples your DNA very closely, called a microarray or a DNA chip. That sort of use in clinics is beginning, and major clinics are in the middle of huge projects to ramp that up. That's going to be increasing at a place like the Mayo Clinic or Children's Hospital in Boston or the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York and similar institutions in Illinois and around the Middle West. So those efforts are stepping up very, very rapidly right now. You know, that company that I mentioned a minute ago, IonTorrent, is going to place a machine at Massachusetts General Hospital later this year for this sort of thing. So I think the first use has been and is diagnostics to help chart a course of treatment. The hope, of course, is that this will also help us to develop new drugs or to rescue drugs that are sort of on the shelf because a lot of people had bad side effects to them. Well, maybe there's a percentage that would be helped. Maybe we could get some of those back off the shelf to help the one-third of all patients or whatever who would be helped. So that sort of thing seems rather imminent.
All right. We have a caller here, I believe, in Champaign on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes. Can your guest speak about the genetic evidence of, I don't know about hominids, but Neanderthals? I recently have heard about that they're in the present-day Homo sapiens, there is evidence of ancestry with Neanderthals.
Yes, there was published earlier this year, apparently, a pretty good sequence of the DNA of Neanderthals. That was kind of a tough business because you couldn't find Neanderthal bones that weren't contaminated by tens of thousands of years, plus a lot of microorganisms, plus a lot of humans that had handled them. They finally found some relatively pure samples of DNA and worked out over probably 10 years the methods to analyze them. This is done primarily at a place in Leipzig in Germany with allies all over the world, and they did publish a Neanderthal sequence. And when they did that, that's just a little bit earlier this year, they did find some evidence of a few traits, a few genes inherited from Neanderthals by humans. Not, it would appear, in Africa, but in groups of people who spread out over the world after leaving Africa. They seem to have had some intermixture with Neanderthals, not very much, but enough so you can see traces of Neanderthal genes in in Europeans and Asians.
Well, again, other questions welcome. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just something else I know thought you might be, you were interested in talking a little bit about, where I expect that we should see more and more ways in which genetic science penetrates our life. And one of the things that's been sort of an issue over this past summer has been companies that are wanting to market over-the-counter genetic tests. So the idea is that you would go, you could just go into a pharmacy and you could, off the shelf, you could pick something. You would give them a sample. You'd swab the inside of your cheek. You'd send it back to them. And then they would do a screen. And then presumably something would come back that would tell you about your genetic risk for a particular disease. And there were a lot of questions raised by this. The FDA said, well, we think this is a medical device, and we think we should be able to regulate it. A lot of other people said, well, just give, what is the value of telling the person that information, even if it is accurate? There seem to be all sorts of questions about this whole, what may well be a growing field of genetic counseling and how it is that will happen and when and where that should happen.
Well, some company, this is often referred to as direct-to-consumer marketing of genetic tests. And there have been a few companies in the past that used this in a much cruder form as a way to sell you vitamins and things like that, the so-called nutrigenomics people. But more recently, more reputable companies, including one with some investment from Google, whose founder is married to the CEO of the company called 23andMe, those people came on the market about 3 years ago and began marketing tests direct to consumers, not in stores. You would contact them and pay a fee of $400 or even more to some other companies like Navigenics and 20 and DecodeMe. You would send in the swab that you mentioned. They would do a test, and using one of these DNA chips that I mentioned, and you would then get a kind of you get a set of risk measurements or propensity, probabilities of your at being at risk for such and such a disease. Those companies went on the market about 3 years ago. This spring, another company, Pathway Genomics, wanted to sell a device through Walgreens and CVS. Mm-hmm. That's when the FDA stepped in. From the very beginning, people have said that the value of this information, and the value of this information from these companies, by the way, is increasing very rapidly because of more and more knowledge, that it's still a little difficult to make clinical use of it. They're saying this is not ready for prime time. Why don't you concentrate on your family history of illness? And people are encouraged to contact their relatives and really think about what the family history of illness is. There's even a website at the NIH that you can do your family history. So there's a lot of controversy about it. At the moment, it's not quite clear what's going to happen next, but the companies that are not selling it through a drugstore are very much still in the market and have thousands of customers. Mm.
Well, that gets it, I think, this question that... the question of what exactly is the relationship between genes and disease, and that it would be nice if there could be a one-to-one relationship we could draw between a particular gene or maybe even between a couple of genes and one's tendency to develop disease. But it seems that it doesn't quite work that way.
Well, you have 3,000 of these rare diseases that I guess I was mentioning that earlier. And these are afflicting a few hundred children a year or a few thousand children. If you say that 2 or 3% of the babies born in the United States have one of these rare diseases, we're talking about 100,000 children born every year in the United States afflicted with one or another rare diseases. This is a serious serious business.
Mm-hmm.
So it's and those are what are called Mendelian diseases, or another way to put it is single-gene diseases. So we have plenty of those around. what's causing the agony is that we're also looking at, let's say, heart disease or diabetes or Alzheimer's or autism or whatever, and everyone understands that that's not a single gene disease. That's a multiple gene disease, and that's not just you have to add up a little stack of genes. It's that these various things interact with each other, and so you have instantly made the picture very, very complicated. But we do know, and we've known from the very beginning, that there are influences, genetic influences, on how much cholesterol is floating around in your blood. And if there's too much, you're going to get very sick very early.
Do you think, though, that we'll get to a point where we'll have a better, a much better understanding of these multi-gene diseases? And also, there's another element here, and that has to do with how you live your life and things that you might be exposed to in the environment. That's going to have an interaction as well. Will we get to a point where we would have a better understanding of how exactly that works?
Oh, I think we're getting a slightly better understanding of these things almost every day. I think the take-home lesson in some ways is that this type of thinking about human health is continually penetrating your life more practically every day, so that the role of genetics along with the environment in your health is going to become more manifest. We're all going to be thinking about this a lot more, and so will our healthcare professionals be thinking about it. It's going to be a bigger voice at the table when any of our medical problems are discussed. And also, the awareness of these factors is certainly going to reinforce at least some people's readiness to alter their own environment, which they have control over, to minimize their risks.
The more we learn about the human genome and the genome of other things, plants and animals, that should give us a better understanding of ways in which that could be manipulated. And that is the kind of one of those things that worries people a lot, that it would be the possibility, not even set aside what might be done with humans, set aside other animals and plants to create in ways that we never could before, novel organisms that never existed before. And people worry about that. Is there reason to worry about that?
Well, I think there is reason to worry about it in case something acquired bad characteristics that caused genuine environmental damage or a risk to human health. We are aware of those possibilities. We look at that extremely, we in this case means companies and regulatory authorities and so on. So we're aware of that, and we regulate to be sure that that everybody looks extremely carefully at potential risks. On the other hand, the productivity of the world's farm fields is not going to be enhanced without genetically modified crops. We already have those in large scale in the United States, and we have them in China, and we're going to have them everywhere. We have 9 billion people in the world in 2040. That's another 2 billion people. And we're going to have to feed them on fewer acres with smaller environmental damage. And for that, we're going to have to genetically manipulate plants. There's no way out of that. We're already doing it, and we're just going to have to get used to it.
There are all sorts of questions raised by this work. Now, the project has indeed set aside some money to try to address those particular issues, ethical, legal, social issues. And I think also, again, here, I think some with justification, people make criticism about how it is we approach new technologies and that we tend sometimes to embrace them enthusiastically first and then afterwards start thinking about the implications. Are we, do you think, doing what we should be doing at this point? And, you know, given the fact that things are moving so quickly, in thinking about these other things, these ethical, legal, social issues that arise?
Yeah, we have a lot of concern about that already. You know, all the big health institutions, the health research institutions, have institutional research boards that are constantly reviewing a proposed piece of research and they're looking at those from both practical and ethical considerations. That's kind of built into the medical research system. Of course, ethical problems about who should know what and when, that's there from the beginning of being of having medical care of any kind. You know, do you tell someone that they are suffering from an incurable disease? Do they want to know that? That issue, which is one that gets constantly brought up with human genome research, mm-hmm. that issue is right on the table in everyone's medical care all the time. And we are used to asking questions like end-of-life care and what does the person who is actually doing the dying want, and whether the children can let go, et cetera, all of those issues. Those are right there, smack on everyone's table right now. So the kinds of issues that come out of the Genome Project are classical.
I just wonder if we'll have any better answer to those questions a year from now or 5 years from now, because it seems that when we were talking about getting to this point years ago, those questions were on the table even then.
Yes, they've always been there. It's like a Greek chorus going alongside of human genomic research. And I think we will know more, and I think everyone should try to understand genetics better and understand its impact on health and be ready to talk with their families and with their healthcare providers about this more and more as we go along. Just step by step, we are going to learn more. And we're going to, I think also because of the genome showing how very much alike everyone is, it's going to, I think, increase our sense of human dignity and caring for other people and our awareness of our links to other people. All of that, the more self-respect we have and are ready to give to others, the better it's going to be for tackling individual medical issues.
All right, we'll have to leave it at that. The story is a very interesting one, and if you want to read it, look for the book Drawing the Map of Life, Inside the Human Genome Project by our guest, Victor McElhenney. He's a science writer, has reported for Science Magazine, the Boston Globe, the New York Times. He founded the Knight Science Journalism Fellowship at MIT and ran it from 1982 to 1998. His new book is published by Basic Books. And Mr. McElhenney, thanks very much.
Delighted to be here. Thank you so much.